Slate's coverage of food systems is made possible in part by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. Welcome to Slate's Table to Farm. I'm Laura Anderson, Slate's food and drink editor, and joining me here in New York is Dan Patchman, the host of the Sporkful Food Podcast. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Laura.
Each week in this podcast, we start at our table and we choose a particular food or ingredient, and then we investigate where it comes from. Finally, we cook it and eat it. Today, we're looking at soda, and we're going to make a Coca-Cola cake.
I will be honest, Laura, I had no idea what a Coca-Cola cake was until you suggested it for this episode.
Yeah, I think I first saw the idea in my mom's Southern Living cookbook when I was growing up, and it always sort of stuck with me, even though I've never had one before.
So she had it in a cookbook, but she never made it for you.
Right, never made it for me. I mean, it's kind of a crazy concept. It's like, let's make a normal sheet cake, but instead of using buttermilk, let's add this liquid that has like way more sugar in it than like buttermilk or milk.
And also that is not at all reminiscent of milk or buttermilk.
Right, not at all. I mean, I think some people claim that, it confers this wonderful cokey flavor into your cake. We're going to have to judge that when we make it.
That's right.
I feel like we should make it clear that we're not endorsing Coca-Cola in particular. It's just that we couldn't resist the alliteration of Coca-Cola cake.
And the other quick thing we should let people know is we're actually going to take a slightly different tack with this episode. Instead of talking about where soda comes from, we're going to be exploring both sides of the controversy surrounding soft drinks. Do they contribute to obesity? Is obesity necessarily bad in and of itself? And should the government try to get people to consume fewer soft drinks?
So later on, we're going to be talking to a Slate columnist who has argued pretty persuasively against soda taxes. But joining us now from Hilton Head, South Carolina, is one of the country's leading experts on obesity and a vocal proponent of soda taxes. His name is Kelly Brownell. Dr. Brownell is the James Roland Angel Professor of Psychology at Yale University, and he's also the director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale. Kelly, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
How did we come to be at this place where soda is such a controversial issue? How did soda come to be so ubiquitous in our lives and also so very amply portioned?
The country pretty much agrees unanimously that obesity is a major public health problem, costing the country lots of money and doing lots of bad things for human well-being. And that, of course, leads to a search for what the culprits are. And there are a lot of different things contributing to obesity, both on the dietary front and on the physical activity front. But on the dietary front, where you start looking at food groups that are contributing a lot to the problem, soda has really become, sugared beverages have become public enemy number one. These beverages are the single greatest contributor of added sugar to the American diet. They come with no nutrition at all. Even a salty snack food has at least a little nutrition, and these have none at all. They're very heavily marketed. Kids are marketed to in a quite extreme way. And then there's also the addictive properties of sugar and a known addictive substance, caffeine, sometimes added in quite large amounts to these. And then the final issue that most people don't know about, but it's quite interesting and important, is that the body doesn't seem to recognize calories very well when they get delivered in liquids. That is, you just don't feel as full. If you consume 100 or 200 calories and it comes in a bottle of sugared beverage compared to a solid food, it could be pizza, donuts, or ice cream for that matter, you're just not going to feel as full. You're not going to register the calories as well.
You referenced the idea that sugar is addictive. And I think that gets into kind of one of the interesting questions about soda and the policy debate over taxing sodas. How much control do the people who are consuming these beverages in large quantities have over that consumption? So I think it's interesting that you come at this from primarily from a psychologist perspective. So can you tell us a little bit more about the psychology of soda consumption and of addiction as it relates to this issue?
Well, the question you're raising is, do these beverages hijack the brain in some way, like traditional substances of abuse might? And certainly people know that caffeine is an addictive substance. I mean, it's not addictive like morphine or heroin or something, but it certainly is addictive. It creates cravings. It creates withdrawal symptoms and things like that. And some people think for the cola drinks like Coke and Pepsi that the caffeine is naturally in these drinks, but a lot of it's added. People don't realize that, and for obvious reasons, the companies add it. But then the question is, what about the sugar? And there has been a lot of research in the past several years using both lab animal studies and studies with humans using brain imaging techniques to see how the brain responds to sugar. And sugar seems to activate the same reward pathways in the brain that classic substances of abuse activate. And people are now beginning to say that, well, does the sugar set up cravings? Does it set up withdrawal? Does it set up tolerance, which means you'd need more of it over time to create the same pharmacologic effect? And the answer to those questions seem to be increasingly yes, yes, yes.
What do you make of the idea that soda taxes unfairly punish poor people?
Well, just about any tax unfairly punishes poor people because poor people have less income to spend on things. But where taxes are regressive, and it's a particular concern, is when you tax something that people need. So if you were to tax, you know, water, for example, or to tax gasoline or to do something like that, as government sometimes does with gasoline, then you could argue that it disproportionately hurts the poor. But with these soda taxes, people also argue that obesity and diabetes are regressive diseases. That is, that they really hurt the poor communities because people are more susceptible to the diseases, their diets tend to be worse, and the health care isn't as good for people in these social groups. And then also government can help offset any concern with this by using the revenue from the tax for programs that would really help the poor. So let's say you used it to subsidize fruits and vegetables and to drive down their costs, then that would help people in the most in the lowest income brackets.
You said at the outset the country agrees that obesity is a public health problem. And, I mean, I think that's probably true, although there are some voices, and I'm sure you've heard some of them, who believe that perhaps it's an issue of correlation and not causation, that there are heavy people who are pretty healthy and thin people who are unhealthy, and that actually poverty is a better indicator of early mortality than obesity is. What do you make of the notion that perhaps obesity in and of itself isn't as clear of an indicator of health as some people may make it sound?
Well, certainly there are some people who are in the heavier weight categories who will live a long time. There are also some people who smoke cigarettes and live to be 110. But on average, people really get hurt by cigarette smoking and by being overweight. So the results, the scientific studies on these are really quite clear. There are some naysayers, but for the most part, most experts around the world agree that as weight goes up, risk goes up. Now, that doesn't eliminate the impact of poverty, as you said, because poverty brings medical risk for all kinds of things. And so certainly it would be better to not be poor, but it would also be better not to be overweight. And if we stand idly by and just let weight continue to go up around the country, then we're going to have to sit idly by and accept the increasing health care costs and the human toll from this.
Studies have shown that it's very, very difficult for people who are obese or overweight to lose weight and keep it off. That seems to just like throw a wrench into the idea that we can treat obesity on a population level. So can you talk a little bit more about what do the policies that you endorse hope to achieve?
It's a very difficult problem to treat. And when you do treat it, it can be pretty expensive. And the nation just doesn't have the money to put toward massive rollout of treatment programs. So prevention of the problem makes all the sense in the world. And in that sense, the parallel with smoking is quite obvious. Once people start smoking, it's pretty darn hard to stop. So you're much better off spending your resources in encouraging people not to ever start. And the same thing is really true with obesity. And that's why there's so much focus on children.
You made a couple references, Kelly, to the cost of obesity, the cost of the consumption of things like sweet sodas. And you know, I know that you and your colleagues at the Rudd Center have done work on the issue of discrimination against obese people, as well as the other issues that you guys deal with. I'm wondering, you know, but at the same time you're talking about the cost, I'm wondering if you're ever concerned that one of your goals may interfere with the other, that in working so hard to alert people to the public health issues you see, and in particular the cost to all Americans of obesity, that in the process you're turning skinny people against fat people.
there are some people who raise this issue that you can't really fight obesity as a problem without inadvertently fighting against obese people themselves. But now, my colleagues and I don't believe that's true. In fact, my colleague at Yale, Rebecca Poole, runs the largest center in the world on dealing with weight bias, discrimination, and stigma. And we care deeply about this issue and fight hard against it. And we believe it's quite easy to see a world where you could try not to have, work to not have the problem and to fight obesity as a problem, but have compassion for the people who have it and give them as much care and attention and medical intervention as need be. And in that way, it would be similar to alcoholism. You'd rather not have alcoholism, but you want to have compassion for the people that have it and provide them services. The same thing would be true for depression. You can fight depression as a disorder without having to fight against people who are depressed. And there's a very long list of such things, and I believe that's very important, to have compassion and kindness for people who are overweight, to fight discrimination in settings like schools and businesses and medical care settings, but to try to do what you can to prevent obesity from occurring.
And I'm curious to ask you, I mean, you've talked in the past pretty openly about your own struggles with weight. I'm curious how your own personal struggles with that issue have informed and affected your work.
Well, my weight's gone up and down, and it is a struggle for me. But I don't know that it's had such a big impact on the way I think about the problem, because there are lots of other people in my field who are fighting the same sort of issues we're fighting on, who are in lots of different weight categories themselves.
But do you feel it's easier for you to have that compassion that you just discussed?
Well, probably, but I think there are a lot of people who have the same compassion who don't struggle with their weight.
Final question for you, Kelly. Laura and I, as part of this podcast episode, are making Coca-Cola cake. Can you put on your psychologist hat if you weren't wearing it already and convince us that we shouldn't feel bad about ourselves?
Well, I've never heard of Coca-Cola cake. I'd be quite interested to see it, although I've heard of fried Pepsi at state fairs in the Midwest.
Fried Pepsi? Oh, my God. We should be making fried Pepsi.
That's right. When do you get on that, Laura?
I think Coca-Cola cake is this kind of old, you know, mid-century relic. People don't really make it that much anymore. But I think it was the sort of thing that was invented by cola companies in order to give people even more reasons to buy their product.
Well, good luck with that dining experience.
I'm going to choose to take that as an endorsement.
Thank you so much for joining us. Kelly Brownell is the James Roland Angel Professor of Psychology at Yale University, and he is the director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity. Thanks, Kelly.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, Laura, I don't think Kelly Brownell wanted to try our Coca-Cola cake.
I think you're right.
I don't know what.
He didn't sound super enthusiastic about the idea.
Yeah, I don't know what tipped us off, but I'm just pretty sure that was the vibe. That's the vibe I got.
So I was really interested by what he said about stigmatizing, or rather not stigmatizing, obesity and comparing it to depression and alcoholism. I don't know if I totally agree with that argument. I absolutely believe that Dr. Brownell does not want to stigmatize obese people, but I'm not sure if it's possible to have a war against obesity, or to fight obesity, in air quotes, without you know, promoting the idea that obese people are in some way deficient or bad. Part of the problem with comparing obesity to alcoholism or depression, I think, is that there's no sort of aesthetic component to the way that people feel about alcoholism or depression, whereas I think many people have a sort of aesthetic problem with obesity because we live in a culture that really glorifies being thin.
It's a visceral reaction. There are people who will see an obese person have a viscerally negative reaction, I think is the point kind of you're making.
Exactly.
I agree 100%, and I think really what it boils down to is the question of, to what degree are obese people responsible for their own obesity? To what degree is it a choice? And the problem is that it's a gray area. There's not a clear answer. It's just like in that case, I think there is a fair parallel to, let's say, alcoholism. There are you may have a genetic predisposition towards alcoholism or towards obesity. That's not necessarily your fault. You were born that way. Circumstances in your life may have conspired to push you in a certain negative direction. But I'm sure that at some point in your life, you also made conscious choices that helped push things in that direction that you could have, where you could have made a different choice. Not everyone with a genetic predisposition towards obesity or alcoholism ends up being obese or alcoholic. I'm not saying that it's all one or the other. I'm just saying you're talking about the way that society stigmatizes obese people. And I think part of the reason for that stigma is a visceral negative reaction to seeing obese people. Part of it is also the presumption that these people have made choices on their own that have helped put them in this situation.
And to further explore those shades of gray, let's introduce our next guest. Daniel Ingwer is a Slate columnist. He's written extensively on obesity and on whether soda should be taxed. Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we just talked to Kelly Brownell, who's a giant in the field of pushing forward for the soda tax and other similar kind of reforms or policies. You don't exactly see eye to eye with Dr. Brownell. You're not exactly mortal enemies either. So,
right.
So why don't you tell us, for people who haven't read all of your columns, give sort of your take on soda taxes as a policy and the obesity issue.
Well, I mean, I think there's two questions. The first being, would a soda tax be effective? Would it help in any way? There's a very good reason to think that a soda tax would reduce soda consumption. But the question of whether that would be really that fantastic for public health is a little bit more obscure. And then the second – so that's sort of my first category of questions about this. And then the second is it fair? And this is, you know, even if you do sort of a public health good for soda drinkers to restrict their consumption, is that fair to the people who happen to like soda as opposed to the people who happen to get all of their excess calories from other sources?
Like beer?
Like beer, yeah, or ice cream or whatever.
People in favor of the tax, though, have been quick to try to draw the comparison to the tobacco industry and taxing cigarettes. Did taxing cigarettes work?
Well, it did. Taxing cigarettes did work in terms of reducing consumption of cigarettes. And there's been, on both sides of the soda tax issue, very clear efforts to kind of borrow strategies from the tobacco fight. So the beverage industry is sort of sowing uncertainty, and they're funding a whole bunch of review papers. And then on the other side of it, advocates for the soda tax are going to all this trouble and to create this rhetoric of sugar as a toxin, as an addictive drug, and all this language of brain chemicals to talk about it.
You're someone who actually takes the time and reads a lot of these studies. Am I to take it then that you're not persuaded by the idea that there's brain chemistry at play?
Well, I'm not persuaded that there's brain chemistry at play with soda that's not at play with any other food that we like, but the notion that big food manufacturers are unique in their efforts to appeal to our deep brain, you know, lizard brain desire for sugar, fat, and salt, as opposed to, you know, any chef at any restaurant. I mean, people have been trying to create food that appeals to us for as long as people have been making food.
Yeah, we've been scratching that itch for a while.
yeah, exactly.
But why should people be able to drink 64-ounce big gulps of soda? I see your point that soda appeals to us in the same way that many other foods do, but most people don't sit down and eat a gallon of ice cream all at once.
Yet gallons of ice cream are available for people who are want to have a lot of ice cream.
But they're
around.
Not sold as individual portions.
Right. So, I mean, there is a lot of interesting and useful evidence to say that the obesity epidemic runs alongside an increase in portion size. And that's certainly true for soda, but it's also true for other kinds of food. So slices of pizza are bigger than they used to be.
Right. But I think, I mean, yes, I get what you're saying, that everything's getting bigger. People are getting fatter. In part, at least, it's a result from eating so much more. The argument goes that the reason why, and you've even written about this in some of your work, the reason why you start with soda as opposed to just limiting portions on every food in the world all at once, or at least why soda is a top culprit is that A, there's no nutritional value in it or almost none, and that B, that we tend not to perceive satiety in the same way when we're drinking these unhealthy beverages. At least if you eat a couple of slices of pizza, you'll be full afterwards.
Right. So that's the argument why maybe soda is worse than pizza, although that's where we get into this realm that it's very hard to prove that soda is causing more obesity than pizza. As far as the argument that, you know, soda has no nutritive value, so we shouldn't drink it. I mean, that strikes me as a very disturbing idea that we can't do anything for pleasure. Seeing art has no nutritive value. That's maybe a ridiculous example. But eating cheese, delicious cheese, you know, that's just almost pure fat, has no real value in our diet. We should just be eating, you know, fruits and vegetables all the time.
I love the idea of just being like, what should we do this weekend, honey? Should we go to MoMA or drink a Coke? I just can't decide.
But the other thing I just want to challenge you on is, you know, we all know we're getting fatter. That's what you said. In fact, in recent years, we're not getting fatter. Obesity rates have leveled out or they're declining. We can't just sort of assume as baseline that the America is getting fatter and fatter and fatter, and by 2050, you know, 95% of the population will be obese and we'll all be dying at age 40. That's simply not true.
Would it be a problem if 95% of the population were obese? Is obesity a problem per se?
The diseases that are associated with obesity are a problem. I mean, they're killing people. It's possible to be obese and not have diabetes. It's possible to be obese and not have high blood pressure. And this is a tricky question because there are some people who are metabolically healthy but overweight. In fact, the best epidemiology says that people who are in the overweight category actually live longer than people in the normal category. People who are in the stage one obesity category are at no increased risk of death. Talking just about risk of death, not about risk of morbidity or illness.
Let's talk now, Dan, because you've written and you made the point kind of at the outset that part of your objection, or at least your concern with these policies, is that you feel like they are unfair. Mm-hmm. Why are they unfair?
Well, I just think, is a soft drink really any worse for you than a cup of you know, pomegranate juice? And if you actually look at it, a cup of pomegranate juice has more carbs than a cup of Coca-Cola. All of this stuff, I think, is really tied into sort of money and class, and the fact that, you know, the greatest health risk of all for the people who are drinking soft drinks is simply the fact of being impoverished. It's much worse to be poor than it is to be fat for your health.
Kelly Brownell made the argument when we spoke to him earlier that it's possible to fight obesity as a public health problem without stigmatizing obese individuals if you do it with compassion and if you understand that it's really difficult, if not impossible, to lose weight and keep it off. I don't know if I totally agree with that argument. I don't know if it's completely possible to avoid stigmatizing individuals, but I'm wondering if you think that that's a very strong issue. I know that many fat acceptance proponents focus a lot on stigma. Do you think that that's a big problem?
I think it is. I mean, the big way to avoid stigma and discrimination, worsening discrimination, is by focusing on, you know, what in the fat acceptance movement they like to talk about health at every size, the idea that you just want to improve diets and lifestyles for everyone, regardless of how thin or fat they are. But in terms of actual, you know, effectiveness, stigmatizing obesity seems to work. I mean, it works in one sense in that the demographics that have the greatest anti-obesity attitudes also have the lowest average BMI. So, but is that a bargain you really want to make?
Dan, what do you think about public health campaigns that are meant to educate people about the risks, the ostensible risks of obesity? Do you think that those kinds of campaigns have any place in promoting public health?
Well, I mean, I think there's a real difference between education and propaganda. I mean, when I hear the word education, I think, you know, spreading facts. And some of these ads are misleading. In New York City, there was a big campaign to say, you know, if you have a soda a day, you're going to put on 10 pounds in such an amount of time. And that's only true in by some really insane accounting that no nutritionist believes in. You know, I worry about sort of discriminating pleasures. So, you know, this idea that we think of soda as sort of a cheap, chintzy pleasure that we don't approve of. I mean, Kelly Brownell himself has written that, you know, if poor people can't afford to drink soda anymore after the soda tax goes into effect, well, fine, they can drink water. And that just sounds really twisted to me, that the idea that, you know, water is just as good as soda. It's clearly not. If it was just as good as soda, no one would drink soda. But this idea that, okay, soda is a nasty, as a pleasure that we, as the enlightened ones, think is not worth having. It's cheap. And yet you could have pomegranate juice or wine or beer, whatever we choose to drink. These are more refined pleasures that are somehow not as bad. And that kind of discriminating among pleasures is what I find most upsetting about this. And unfair. That's what I mean by unfair. Just the other day, I was on a road trip eating veggie booty with my toddler nieces. And I don't think that my sister-in-law would give my nieces Doritos, but I looked up Doritos and veggie booty on my phone to see what the nutritional content is. And I mean, it's the same stuff, but somehow, you know, veggie booty is because it has vegetables in it or something is not as bad as Doritos. I think we distinguish between things for no reason.
Dan, we're making Coca-Cola cake for this episode of our podcast. Have you ever had Coca-Cola cake? What?
I was just going to go on a whole thing about how I have a cookbook called Cooking with Dr. Pepper and 7-Up, which is it's amazing. It's just like anytime there's sugar in a regular recipe, you use 7-Up instead. And anytime there's would be barbecue sauce in another recipe, you just use Dr. Pepper.
Have you tried these recipes?
No, I haven't. I mean, it's just some of them are really strange when you think about the implications. Like barbecue chicken made with Dr. Pepper is just going to be like a highly caffeinated barbecue chicken that you could just be like wired on chicken.
This is a whole book?
I would call it a booklet.
Is it spiral bound?
No, staple bound.
I think we need to acquire this book, Dan.
Yeah, we need to get this book.
You can get it for free by writing to the company.
What company?
The 7-Up company, or whoever owns 7-Up at this point.
Dan Ingber is a Slate columnist. Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Really good.
Thanks, Dan. I'm glad you like it.
It's very similar to gingerbread.
It is similar to gingerbread. So
in a good way. I mean, I love gingerbread.
That was intentional, so I'm not taking that as an insult. most Coca-Cola cake recipes that I was able to find follow this similar formula. I think it's originally from Southern Living, but it's just a sheet cake with cocoa in it and a sort of chocolatey frosting, only it obviously has Coca-Cola in it. I recalled a chocolate gingerbread recipe that I love from one of Nigella Lawson's cookbooks. And I thought, well, Coke is kind of spicy. It has that sort of, you know, ineffable spicy quality. So I wanted to bring that out. So I added some spices to this. I added some molasses. I also discovered that most Coca-Cola cake recipes call for a little bit of buttermilk. But I was like, look, if I'm going to make a Coca-Cola cake recipe, I want to have as much Coca-Cola in there as possible.
A Coca-Cola cake recipe for the Table to Farm episode about soda.
Right. We need to just like – the goal was maximization of Coca-Cola.
It's really good though. We'll put the recipe up on the show page.
We will.
Which is slate.com/table to farm. And I guess sort of in closing here, Laura, I mean, I thought Dan Engber made a lot of really good points. I certainly came in generally in favor of soda taxes and policies to get people to drink less of it, but not 100%. I guess basically what it comes down to for me is I am sympathetic to that libertarian viewpoint, or really sort of old-fashioned liberal, small L liberal viewpoint, that you should be able to do whatever you want as long as you're not hurting anyone else. That being said, I think oftentimes when people use that as their argument, they are underestimating or ignoring the ways in which their actions end up affecting other people. You may think that just drinking a lot of soda and getting really fat is your choice and you should be able to do it if you want. But actually that affects all of us. It affects the cost that we all pay for healthcare. If you die at a younger age, that affects your family. It affects your children. If you are extremely obese and you have a lot of health problems, that may affect your ability to earn money and support your family. And now your children are being hurt by this. And so there is a societal cost to obesity. And I think it does behoove all of us to try to reduce it. That being said, and I generally hate slippery slope arguments, but
they are a fallacy.
They are usually a fallacy, but in this case, I mean, look, at a certain point, the link between cause and effect is getting less and less clear. Now, as Dan Engber has explained, the link between drinking a lot of soda and becoming obese and having these negative effects on society is not as definitive, and there are many other things that could have the same effects that we're not talking about in the same conversation.
I do wish that there were a way, as Dan Engber pointed out, to include other types of sugary beverages in our discussion of soft drinks, things like pomegranate juice and orange juice and, you know, any sort of liquid sugar delivery system, I think should fall under the same category regardless of what kind of people drink it. But as Dan Engber pointed out, overweight people tend to live longer than normal weight people. Like, there's a lot that isn't understood about the relationship between weight and health. And so for that reason, I just shy away from arguments that try to conflate obesity with negative health.
Okay. I mean, I think that if you're going to be concerned about the fact that there's a lot we still don't understand about this, I mean, by that logic, it seems to me every month there's a new fad or a new trend about what the thing we're all not supposed to be eating is. And by that logic, we really shouldn't have any policies to try to dissuade people from consuming anything, or we should try to dissuade them from consuming everything, because next month it's all going to change anyway.
I think that one thing we can all agree on is that the thing that we shouldn't be eating is Coca-Cola cake.
Speaking of which, let me take another bite. I like the frosting. What's in the frosting?
Coke. That just about does it for this week. Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Laura.
Dan's food podcast is called The Sporkful. You can search for it on iTunes, or you can find it at sporkful.com. You can also get our very own Coca-Cola spice cake recipe, which I was just kidding before. Everyone should be eating this. It is not something that you should shy away from eating.
It's really good.
You can find the recipe on our show page, which is slate.com/tabletofarm. Join us next week when we'll be talking about how many edible products you can get out of a pig.
Pulled pork.
Bacon.
Roast pork.
Ham hocks. I can keep going.
Pork rinds.
Tenderloin.
Pork belly. Ribs.
There are a lot of them.
It's going to be a long show.